Today, a truly independent RBA. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. There was a very good article in The Conversation, and it was relating to the announcement following the review of the RBA that Jim Chalmers wants to disconnect himself and Treasury from any decisions they might take. This is what the article said. Might Jim Chalmers have forgotten Labour Party history? The Treasurer says he's on board with all of the recommendations of the independent review of the Reserve Bank. One of them, the first, is to make the bank truly independent of the government that owns it by removing the Treasurer's power to overrule its board. At the moment, the Reserve Bank of Australia Act makes it clear that in the event of a disagreement between the government and the bank's board, the government has the right to force the bank to do its bidding. In order to overrule the board, the Treasurer must submit a recommendation to the Governor-General, and the Governor-General, acting on the advice of the Federal Executive Council, may by order determine the policy to be adopted by the bank. The Treasurer is required to inform the House of Representatives of his actions within 15 sitting days. It's a clause that has never been used, and the review didn't think it was useful to say that if an elected government controlled monetary policy, it could limit the credibility of the bank's commitment to deliver low and sustainable inflation. But Australian and Labour Party history suggests it's there for a reason. Back in 1930, the Scullion Labour government was only in office 2 weeks before it was hit by the 1929 Wall Street crash and the beginnings of the Great Depression. The Australian government and the states had all borrowed heavily from London and faced a huge servicing cost at a time when the prices of Australian leading exports of wool and wheat slumped. The London capital markets refused to lend anything else to Australia, and that, along with all of Australia's state governments cutting back spending, put the Australian economy into free fall. Labour Treasurer Edward G. Theodore was economically enlightened and believed, along with economist John Maynard Keynes, that it made sense to use debt finance public works to soak up unemployment. Theodore wanted Australia's Reserve Bank, then called the Commonwealth Bank, to issue treasury bills to finance the public works and provide relief to farmers. In his way stood the independent Commonwealth Bank board and its astute chairman, Sir Robert Gibson, who was an unswerving devotee of sound finance and wary of budgets that weren't balanced. In April 1931, Gibson wrote to Theodore warning that a point was being reached beyond which it would be impossible for the Commonwealth Bank to provide further financial assistance for the government in the future. The bank was saying no to the Treasurer. Theodore replied that Gibson's attitude can only be regarded by the Commonwealth government as an attempt on the part of the bank to arrogate itself to a supremacy over the government in the determination of the financial policy of the Commonwealth, a supremacy which I am sure was never contemplated by the framers of the Australian Constitution and has never been sanctioned by the Australian people. Gibson wouldn't budge, and there was no mechanism to break the impasse. Eventually, Theodore backed down. His successor, Joseph Chifley, was one of the commissioners on the 1937 Royal Commission into the banking system. The commission recommended that in any conflict between the bank board and the government over monetary policy, the government should prevail. As Prime Minister, Chifley had the principle enshrined in the Commonwealth Bank Act of 1945, and it was later enshrined in the Reserve Bank Act of 1959. The ultimate supremacy of the government over the Reserve Bank was hard won by Labour, and it is easy to imagine circumstances in which a government might need to use it. Even the knowledge that the trigger is there, never pulled, lets the board know it is not able to go completely rogue and act against the wishes of a democratically elected government. Chalmers, ought to consider the wisdom of keeping his ultimate power in reserve, because one day Chalmers or his successor might wish they had it. Spot on. In fact, Robbie Barwick and I discussed this a couple of weeks ago. This is a critical issue. And the question is, how much power should the central bank have without checks and balances or accountabilities in place? The bottom line is that if Chalmers goes through with this, the central bank essentially has unlimited power, but no accountability and responsibility to the Australian people. That cannot be right. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.